to Clamped, the weekly podcast where we discuss all things related to creating, living, and making projects. I'm your host, Grant Alexander, and joining me as always is Jesse Ratfink. Unfortunately, Adam Mackey isn't here this week, but we do have a special guest. Joining us this week is a guest from the third smallest state in the USA, Connecticut. Working alongside his mother, he helped to breathe new life into an iconic ratcheting screwdriver sets that date back to 1936. Please welcome Joel from Chapman Manufacturing.
Yay!
Thanks for having me. This is exciting.
All right, Joel.
And fellow makers.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. So for those who don't know, you know, who you are and what you do, why don't you, give a elevator pitch?
Sure. So as you said, my name is Joel Camisar, and I'm the owner of Chapman Manufacturing in the tiny state of Connecticut in the tiny town of Durham.
Durham.
Population 7,000, I think.
Oh, wow. Nice.
And we make tiny screwdriver sets. We've been making essentially the same product since 1936. It's a small screwdriver bit and ratchet set.
Yeah.
USA made, completely USA quality, precision manufactured, and we sell globally online, Amazon, huge companies, other makers, you name it.
Yeah. It's, I have honestly, so I don't know, I saw some people using a set, and I don't know if it was a Chapman or not, but it looked very similar. So I'll assume it was a Chapman. And I was like, I need one of those. And I couldn't, like, I didn't know what to Google. And this was like years ago, like 5 or 6 years ago. I didn't know what to Google to figure out, like, how to find this, because I've found myself in so many tight spots working on cars, working on around the house, you know, doing whatever I'm doing and needing to get in there with a screwdriver into a tight spot. And your ratcheting screwdriver is exactly like the perfect thing. What I used to do is like put a ratchet and like a quarter inch like socket and then throw the thing in there, but then it would always fall out. Right. And your system like doesn't let that happen because of it's got like a ball bearing system that captures it. And I love it. And that's why we wanted to have you on. I don't know. I didn't explain that to you beforehand, but that's why I wanted to have you on, because I used your tools and I went, this is quality, and I wanted to talk to you about it and talk to you about, you know, manufacturing. But before we get into all that, we're going to talk about what we're up to this week. We call it What's in Your Clamps. I'm going to start first. I like to do so this week I've actually been working on a bunch of painting and I've been painting my basement. When I moved into the house, we painted like, you know, the main floor and all the rooms upstairs. And 10 years later, well, like 12 years later, we were like, okay, we finally need to paint the basement. It was the nicest paint job in the house when we moved in, but it was no longer there. But so I had done some drywall work a couple years ago during COVID, and I had painted one of the walls this color called ostrich feather. And so I went to the store and I was like, I'd like some ostrich feather. And they're like, okay, well, there's two ostrich feathers coming up. It's like Sherwin-Williams and Bear. And I was like, well, I've never been to a Sherwin-Williams store, so I guess it's Bear. It must be Bear. I get the paint. I paint the whole wall. It dries. It's not the same color. And yeah. And so I go back and I'm like, it's got to be the Sherwin-Williams, right? And I guess I'll just paint it again. So I get like, I go there and I'm like, okay, so the bear wasn't right. It's got to be the Sherwin-Williams. And I get there, I'm like, can I bring my like old can this time? And the Sherwin-Williams isn't the right color either. It's not right. So there's three colors, and there's one that's discontinued, and it was by PPG, like Pittsburgh Paint Group. And it was also ostrich feather. So there's been three people who named their paint ostrich feather. And I was trying to find the one by PPG. I found it luckily. And have now I hate painting, because you always have to do it twice, no matter how good you think you are. You always have to do it twice. There's always a couple spots that you miss. And so I had to do it three times, which was very frustrating. And especially for a basement, which you don't even care about.
No. So yeah. Here's a hot tip. You know what we did when we painted?
Yeah.
Was take off a light outlet cover.
Yeah.
And write the paint code on the inside of it.
Good idea.
That is a very good idea.
Yeah. It was a stroke of genius because you have to take them off to paint anyway.
Well, not if you're the people who painted my previously in my house.
Oh, okay. Or if you're my landlords, I guess.
Yeah. No, like that's like the most recent reel I would put out, because every time I would take a light cover off, underneath was like two different paint colors. And I'm like, how, like, and like, apparently this was professionally done beforehand. According to like the people we bought the house from, it was professionally done, like professionally painted and all that. And every, like, I take a vent cover off and it's white underneath or whatever. And I'm just like so frustrated. But that's a great tip for our listeners. Jesse, what have you been up to?
So after I got the loom assembled, I actually threaded it and I made a scarf, which I'm really excited about. Oops, I'm taking my light, but... for anyone watching, it's rainbow colored and my favorite thing ever now, I think. There are so many mistakes, but I'm really happy with it. Oh, yeah. There really are so many missed stitches, because for the warp fiber, I used a really beautiful wool yarn that was super fragile, so it kept breaking. So the entire time I'm weaving, I'm having to like piece back together the base of the weaving. Yeah. So that was exciting. But I started my second one. It's on a giant loom behind me now. And it's so much easier when you have the right warp thread. Good. It's just amazing how much faster it went. Like, that was probably 5 minutes of weaving and I've already got a couple inches. Wow. So yeah, things are getting better. I'm excited about it. But I'm also waiting for my stained glass kit stuff to get here. I'm going to do stained glass as well. So,
yes.
Yeah, we'll see how that goes.
We'll be talking more about the stained glass project in the future, I am sure, because it may be the clamp challenge. What clamp challenge? Whoa. Joel, what have you been up to?
I'm actually in between projects. I have a lot of material, and I'm trying to figure out what to do with it.
Mm.
So
join the club.
This is good stuff, though. I have an entire rack of 12-foot steel bars that have bends in them.
Oh yeah,
that we have been accumulating since, I don't know, 1936. I have no idea.
Yeah,
there's a lot. And we did mess with some of it. We bought a steel bender. A hand crank steel bar bender. And after kind of figuring it out, we made about a garden arch that's probably, I don't remember the exact measurements, but it's probably 15 feet wide and about 12 foot high.
Whoa, that's awesome.
Yeah, I did some welding and welded that up. It's in our garden right now. And then we also made some little plant supports, like kind of like peony rings.
Mm-hmm.
So that took care of maybe, you know, 0.001%. And I look at it and I'm trying to figure out what the heck to do with the rest of it. And I also have steel coil.
Oh, yeah.
Very small sizes. Over the years, we've kind of modernized our production process. And the newer machines are much more versatile. So they used to buy steel in all different diameters. Where now we don't need to anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm left with is all this steel. And I have a lot of coils as well. And I'm trying to figure out what to do with that. Unfortunately, the steel coil is like 7/64 hex and smaller. So it's
hex.
Hex, yeah.
Yeah, I like this. Yeah, I wish I lived in Connecticut. I'd stop by anytime. Yeah. I can find stuff. Yeah, yeah.
Please take some. So I'm trying to figure out what to do with that. It's not real structural is the issue.
Yeah. But I guess it makes sense for, like, if you have those, you know, like hex makes sense for screwdriver bits, right? Like,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I got a lot of it and we don't use it anymore. And I don't know. I haven't come up with anything brilliant, but maybe one of your listeners will have a great idea.
Yeah, definitely. I am certain there are people out listening. Because we've got a lot of we've got a few metal workers that I know of that listen. So I'm sure there's someone out there who could think of something interesting to do with it. The big thing comes about, and this is something that we can get into a little bit about in the main topic here, is like production and the challenges of production and the challenges of doing something at a like, yeah, sure, you could make something out of that material, but is it worthwhile to make it if you want to produce something? Is it worthwhile to make it? Sure. Anything is worthwhile if you want to have fun and whatever. Is it worthwhile if you want to try and have a business? If you want your business to be making something, that's a completely different dynamic than whether or not you're working in your garage just trying to have some fun on the weekend versus like running a manufacturing business producing something, whatever it is, right?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I mean, all the most of the steel that I was referencing before, we've used for like little personal projects, not that much around the shop. But yeah, I mean, running production is very different than, like playing around in the garage. The biggest thing is that we're on a pretty tight schedule.
Right.
So if your machine goes down, in your garage, you'll, figure it out tomorrow, but we don't, exactly have that luxury. In fact, we were fighting with one of the machines this week.
Oh no.
Yeah. CNCs, on your computer, when it starts acting up and you restart it and the problem magically goes away. Well, production machines are the same. If you're lucky, it gives you a million errors. You restart it and then it decides to run. This one, which might be our fault because all of our machines have names, and we did name this one Glitch. Looking back on it, maybe not the wisest idea.
Yeah.
She was glitching, and we tried the old restart, a couple times, and that didn't work. And just like your PC or Mac, where you can do the same thing 100 times with no issue, and then all of a sudden it's a problem.
Yep.
CNCs are the same way.
I have a CNC metal mill, and every once in a while, like I've used it, not a lot, but I've used it a few times where it just like it's been doing this like, cutting, like going deeper and deeper and cutting out like whatever it is. And then it just goes, guess what? I'm only going to move in one direction now. You're like, why aren't you doing the thing? Why aren't you moving in all the like I was cutting a circle at the time. I was making a car for a part for a race car, and I was cutting like a circle on the mill, which is like obviously lathe work, but use the tools that you got, right? And just started cutting back and forth instead of going. It didn't move anymore in the I guess it's the X direction, whatever. Yeah. Didn't do any X direction. It was only doing Y, and I was like, why? and I just like it had gotten halfway through the part, right? So then you got to like reset the thing, find the zero again. You got to like change where zero is, because if you want to try and salvage the part, which is what I was trying to do, if you're manufacturing, you probably just like take that part and throw it in the garbage. But I had limited material, so I was salvaging the part, changing where zero was. Like, it's like a, very frustrating thing to deal with. Watch it go through the whole thing again, cutting air until it gets down there. Right. And then eventually starts cutting again. You're like, okay, good. But why did you do that? Like, what happened?
Yeah. So then, our machine, it just decided to stop. All of our parts, all of our bits have part numbers. It decided it just didn't want to engrave the part number, even though it had been. Like, just it would, the tool would come up and then it would just skip over it to the next tool. So we're like, restarting it, looking at the program, comparing it to other programs, trying this, trying that. And then, when you run production, I have the lady that's in charge of production coming out and being like, it's been an hour, that's, however many pieces. And other, that's 100 pieces. And I want to be like, that's 100 pieces. We're doing our best here.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it's like always, so, you're always on that deadline, you know?
Yeah, so these are like, so how many people does Chapman Manufacturing employ?
We run about 15 people.
Okay, 15 people.
Not all are full time. Some people have been there for 20 plus years. Actually, one lady retired in 2016 that had been there for 50.
Oh,
yeah.
My gosh.
Yeah, she started in 66 and worked to 2016.
That's amazing. That's,
yeah, so to answer your question, about 15 people, not all full time. And we have nice, diverse group. I mean, every, you know, I have a student who started as a work study through one of the local tech schools.
Oh, yeah.
All the way up, you know, to people in their, 60 plus range. And we find that, you know, it's really beneficial. You know, we have a very team approach, and I kind of feel, and I think everyone else does too, you know, everyone brings something to the table.
Yeah. And that's something, like, when I heard you on the other podcast I listened to, it is like the thing I wish my manager would listen to, like, the worker people, like, in like, there's something that I listened to the Made in America podcast, and you were talking about how, like, if someone has a better idea of how to do something, you listen to them. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. If they have a different idea, you listen to it, because, like, different may not be better, but it might be better for the people who are there. Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And this is,
and, you know, sorry.
No, go ahead.
A lot of people, you know, I know Chapman in and out, that I've been there 11 years this summer, but I don't have the breadth of manufacturing experience that some of the people that work at Chapman do.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So a lot of times they'll say, oh, well, I worked in this one shop and, you know, we made whatever, something completely different. And, you know, when we had this problem, we did this. And I'm like, oh, yeah. Like, what do you think of that? For example, we have machines that put the little ball bearing you referenced before.
Yeah.
In the spring and all of our bits. Well, sometimes someone, you know, something gets knocked over, or the little feeder tube pops out or whatever, and you end up with a bunch of balls and springs on the machine table, on the floor, whatever.
That doesn't sound fun.
No, and they're teeny tiny.
If you push
the end of our bits, the ball bearings are 1/8 inch diameter.
Yeah.
So we used to have to, like, sweep them up and, like, you know, we're going back there with tweezers, trying to, like, take them out of machines, you know, like, pain in the butt. Kind of, it's almost like Operation, you know, that old game where you're
picking up. Yeah.
Until one day someone said, like, well, you know, I used to work with a lot of small parts, and we just had a dedicated vacuum that we would just vacuum them all up with.
Yeah. I love this.
I'm like,
that is so good.
Ball bearings up with tweezers.
Yeah, this is exactly the type of, like, ideas, like, because you wouldn't think about it, because if you thought to vacuum it up, you'd be like, oh, you'd never be able to find it with all the dirt.
Yeah.
Right.
But if you have a dedicated, like,
right
thing, then all of a sudden, oh, I can find it, because that's all we use it for.
Right.
Yeah.
That really makes me wonder if there are beaters out there that do the same thing. Like, they have a hand vacuum that's just for beads, because that is such a smart idea. And yeah, I never would have thought of it.
Yeah, right. I know. And it's sometimes, like, I mean, it's made such a difference, and we laugh about it now. But, you know, sometimes you want to be like, well, okay, and where were you 10 years ago?
That's, like, one of the, like, yeah, it's so funny, because you just, and even if they worked there for the last 10 years, why didn't they say something? You might ask, but it's like, why didn't you ask? Right. Yeah. Like, that's always, like, the question, like the chicken or egg question of, like, well, why didn't you ask? Cause, like, maybe someone could come up with a good idea. Right. But you've been sitting there with the tweezers and, you know, doing it, cause why not? And But, like, I guess, you know, a big thing that you guys are proud of is being made in the USA. And, it is something that I think local manufacturing, whether whatever country you happen to be. You know, I'm Canadian, so Made in Canada is something I support, and, you know, Made in USA, it's pretty close. You know, we have a co-host who's not here tonight, just in Australia, and it's, it doesn't make any sense for you to, like, it doesn't make a lot of sense for someone to manufacture it something and then ship it all the way across the other side of the world unless you are cheap about it, right? Like,
yeah,
and, you know, whatever. But like, what does that mean to you? Why do you want to make, why does Made in America, Made in the USA mean something to you? It's like, why does making something local matter to you?
You know, it's interesting. There's a lot of pros and cons to it. So, you know, obviously, I guess we really feel that we're part of the community, our local community in Durham. You know, we've been there since 1936. So many people in town have worked at Chapman or know someone that worked at Chapman or was affiliated somehow. And it's really nice to keep those jobs here, to keep those, you know, 15 people employed. And, you know, so you could look at it from that way, that it's kind of, you know, we're a part of the community. We want to serve the community. Environmentally, you know, the cost of shipping goods globally, you know, the environmental cost is astounding.
Right. And that's the thing I've never understood. It's like, yeah, I can get a bunch of screwdriver bits for $1 that came from China.
Yeah.
I don't understand how. Because it does, I don't understand how anyone is making any money at that, right? And, but they're garbage. Like, I know I have literally, the amount of screwdriver bits I have thrown in the garbage because I am so mad at them. Because even like using them you're using them in a drill, you might, you know, over torque them. I've got ones that I've over torqued in my hand. And I'm like, this shouldn't be possible. Like, I'm not that strong, right? Like, and whatever I'm doing wasn't that, like, you know, like, it just didn't make any sense to me. I shouldn't be, like, the screw should break before I break my bit, in my mind. But anyway, sorry. That's my, like, well, little rant.
That's actually really interesting you bring that up. Because the import bits usually are made, and I'm not an expert in the process, but it's basically like powdered metal.
Yeah.
That's molded. So they just put this powder in the mold, they heat it up or whatever they do, and they can run, you know, millions and millions and millions of them.
Right.
So the upside is that it costs them, you know, fractions of a penny, and they can make a phenomenal amount very quickly. Mm-hmm. The downside is that if you're molding something, you can't really make a precise shape.
Right.
They don't have sharp edges. They don't have precise shapes like we do. You know, as I said before, we run everything at a 12-foot bar. So they're actually cut or milled into shape. The other difference is that the powdered metal bits don't really have a torque range. Mm. Because they're not, you know, they're not really precisely made. Our bits are designed, milled, and heat treated to specific tolerances and ranges based on the screw they fit.
Right.
So our larger bits are, you know, have a higher torque value, but our smaller bits, and we go down pretty small, you know, like 1/16 hex Allen, a star 6. A metric, the smallest you make is 1.27 millimeters, so they're pretty small.
Yeah.
Those are meant to break before damaging the screw that they fit. Mm-hmm. And the reason is that people use our tools on all kinds of expensive / irreplaceable / very valuable equipment where they would rather break a $2 bit than damage a screw, which could be irreplaceable, like hand cut antique rifle screws, all kinds of crazy things on medical and dental equipment, x-rays, robotics, blah, 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 NASA. So they would rather replace a $2 bit than damage a screw. So that's actually
fair. One of, yeah.
Yeah. That's one of our selling points is that, you know, our bits are designed to break before damaging the screw they fit, and we sell them all open stock. So if you do break one, you can buy another one for, you know, very inexpensively.
I know, so I've used your bits a little bit, and one of the things I love about them is that each one of them has like a knurled end on them.
Yeah.
And I love that because I often find myself like taking a bit, like if you're using a screwdriver, sometimes you just want to like quickly turn it, and like a screwdriver handle is too much. And I love that little knurled end on it, and I don't know why. It's like whenever you're using it, and you're like, my fingers will be faster to unscrew this. You're yeah. like, this is exactly it. Like, that's like, I don't know what it is. It's like somebody has thought this process through and thought about like how much I love to just, I just need the smallest amount. It's right. loose now, but I still like my fingers don't fit on it. I just need that bit. And the bits fit in so nicely because I guess you got, if you're machining them instead of like casting them, they have that like caught, like, I don't know exactly, like, I don't know. It's like, it looks like a hollow ground knife where yeah. I don't know what the term is for, and I'm only going to look at Robertson screws because that's all I care about. The rest of them can all go in the garbage, but
either way, right?
Right. But I just love the way that like the, when I look at any of the other manufacturing, that's not how they're made.
Right.
And it's yeah, the same, well, like slots are the other one that like, you'll see the difference between like a slot that's just like ground, like two pieces ground together versus the Chapman one, which is a hollow ground. I don't know if that's the term, but that's what
yeah, it that is the me. Term. Yeah.
Okay, so there you
most go. Screwdrivers slots are the wedge.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like this, which the benefit is that it's much stronger.
Oh, interesting.
And it's good for opening paint cans and frying stuff or whatever. We've all done that. The downside is that the screw slot isn't shaped like this.
It's shaped like this. Yeah.
So if you have, you know, if you're adjusting screws on, you know, some like $8 million NASA test equipment, you don't want to go in with this and, you know, and beat the crap out of them because, you know, there's a 6-month backlog or whatever. So our screwdrivers are called the hollow ground with the straight side. So it doesn't just put pressure on the bottom of the screw slot. It puts pressure on the sides as well. And that's why we make 14 different size and shape slotted screwdrivers plus metric ones. So you can
metric ones. Wow.
Yeah. You can accurately fit the screwdriver bit to the slot. And that's particularly, you know, that's really, really big. We have a lot of people that do antique gunsmithing on antique firearms.
Right.
And a lot of those screws, especially on the really old ones, are hand cut.
Yeah.
So, and then they're engraved on top of it with the, you know, old engravings. So what they do is they buy our bits and then actually hand grind them to fit exact slot. You know, they'll pick the closest one, hand grind it, and then it's like unique to that one screw.
Wow.
So yeah. I was using war screws to take apart like a 1940s metal lathe, and it has a whole bunch of slot screws because that's what they used back then, right? And I hate them, and I hate them because every other screw driver that I've ever used is a wedge, and they mar everything to bits, right. Especially if you have to do if you have to put any type of torque because it's been painted 17 times or whatever, right?
Slides out.
Yeah. Slides out. And so, but I was using the, like, and I loved the fact that I tried one of the screwdriver bits and it was, oh, that one's just a little too big. And there's like, I don't know how many in the set I have. There's probably like 5 different sizes, but I liked how there was like 5 different sizes instead of being like, when I look in my toolbox, there's like 3. It's like big, medium, and small, and none of them are ever right. But
yeah,
I guess that's.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say that's like one of the things that talks about like precision matters, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. So for our customers, it absolutely matters. I mean, people aren't, you know, using our tools to, you know, open the proverbial paint can or whatever. Our customers use our tools on, you know, all kinds of very precise things, and where damaging a screw is bad.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny. I get emails and phone calls about the horror stories. You know, in fact, one time, one memory that sticks out is that I don't think it was overnighted, but I think it was UPS Red a couple sets to somewhere in East Africa because the only press in the entire region had gone down, the only printing press.
Oh my God.
And they were like trying to reach some screws or something and they couldn't reach them. And then the screwdrivers they had kept like camming out. So this guy called and was like, I need, you know, like three sets immediately. We're losing, you know, $20,000 an hour on this press.
Oh my God.
Well, how fast can you get them to East Africa or where, West Africa, wherever it was? And I'm like, ooh, I don't know. Not that quickly. So, wow. Yeah. So going back to what you're saying, yeah, precision definitely matters. And especially if you're working on things that you don't want to screw up, whether you're restoring it, whether it's something that's incredibly sensitive. You know, I mean, what we found is that a lot of our customers have a lot of crossover between their hobbies and their career. Mm-hmm. So the people that, you know, like your audience, the people that tend to make things, you know, in their free time also tend to use tools at work, whether they're like an X-ray tech, you know, or, you know, piano tuning, or, you know, people that install AV equipment in theaters and stadiums and things like that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for them, precision really matters. And not breaking things really matters, especially if they're big, expensive things.
So what would you say your biggest challenge is when it comes to trying to manufacture something in Connecticut, in, you know, wherever it is, but you're trying to manufacture something in a small town, USA, and keep it made in the USA, right? Like,
yeah, there are challenges. I mean, one of the nice things is that I do have some local suppliers. So unlike people that are getting parts from China, if there's an issue or I want to try something, I can just, you know, get in the truck and drive 20 minutes and
right.
and talk with them face to face.
Well, like Connecticut, for those who don't know, is where the bazooka was originally invented.
Oh yeah. We were like the last 100-150 years where the gun manufacturing, you know,
yeah. Capital of the gun world. And like yeah. Bridgeport, Connecticut, like Bridgeport is like, yeah. Everyone, when people talk about like mills and stuff, they Bridgeport's mm-hmm. the thing, and like that's from Connecticut, right?
Yeah, I mean it was a huge, yeah. huge industrial complex.
Right,
it's all gone, most of it. Just
yeah, well, just Chapman. Chapman's left. No,
yeah, oh, yeah. It feels like it sometimes. But the problem is that, you know, the hard thing is that sourcing new. So, for one example, cases. We have a few different cases, a few different plastic cases.
Mm-hmm.
They have, you know, all kinds of really cool stuff, really cool cases. It's all made in China or Taiwan.
Yeah.
And so when I'm trying to come out with something new or, you know, an alternative version of something, because I do custom work for large companies. Well, you know, right. they'll come and say like, okay, like this case has to have our logo on it and it has to hold 37 bits and it has to be pink with yellow polka dots and whatever. You know, you can get whatever you want made in China or Taiwan, but trying to find that in the US, not easy.
Yeah.
Incredibly difficult for some things. I mean, we really, you know, there's certain products that really just aren't made here. So that really limits, you know, what, and especially for cases, it limits our product line substantially.
So what I love about your case is, and it's like, it's not even the case. It's like when you try and take the bit out, it doesn't fight you. It's, I love it. I'm just like, I try and get the bit out and it comes out. And every other like screwdriver bit thing I have, it is like, you need like a pair of pliers to get it out. And so I don't know, whatever you're doing a good job at it. But is everything that you guys do made in the USA?
Yes.
Everything.
Yeah.
Everything.
And that explains a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. Everything is. And, you know, we've been with some of our suppliers for the cases that have the 24 bits. We've been with that supplier, I think, since the 70s.
Oh, wow. God.
Wow. You know, yeah. One of the interesting things actually is, well, kind of interesting, is that no one kept any records at Chapman.
Yeah.
So
yeah, that's people, crazy.
Yeah. So people email pictures, call, whatever. Oh, I have this old set. It was my grandpa's, great uncle's, you know, stepmother's, dog walker's, aunt's, whatever, whatever. We, you know, how old is it? We're like, I don't know. The bits, I mean, we've been making the same bits since 1936. They look essentially the same. Our ratchet, our little stainless steel ratchet, hasn't changed, really.
Yeah.
Whoa. Materially. Screwdriver handle, we've had a couple of them, but, you know, we use the same ones for decades. So, yeah, we have no clue. We can say sometime after 1936.
Yeah, and before 2024.
Yeah. And that's the thing, you know, you find these good American suppliers, you have to stick with them.
All right. So I guess it's like it, like a lot, like, and I know for myself, like every time I've tried to do a project, like the whole thing is, and I'm like a nothing. I get like in the grand scheme of things, when I go approach a business and I want to do a project and I'm buying, even if I'm buying like $1,000 worth of stuff, it's nothing to them. Right. Yeah. The accounts they have, whether it be a hardwood supplier or a steel manufacturer, whatever I'm going to talk to, if I'm going to spend $1,000, they like the amount of time they spent with me is probably not worth them talking to me, right? Because they have people like you, like you're the amount of money you're spending on steel, like compared to any time I've talked, like the 10 seconds I've talked to an employee, they're like, I could have just talked to Chapman and made so much more money, right? But like I can get, you know, that must be difficult because like my dad worked in like the steel plants growing like just before, like while I was born and stuff. And like steel, like he worked in, you guys had like, I don't know if you guys have Stelco. Stelco was the Canadian side. You guys had like different steel companies around the same area, you know, near the border and, Ontario and probably Michigan and stuff like that. There's a lot of steel companies there and they all shut down, I guess, judging by my age, 40 years ago. You know, it must be difficult to find these local manufacturers of raw materials. So what have you done to try and like how do you source that? Like, what do you do?
Bang my head against the wall when it comes to steel. talk about no buying power. So I buy steel and usually 20,000 pounds at a clip.
Yep.
And so there's the mill and then there's the distributor and then there's little Chapman Manufacturing. Right. So I buy the 20 pounds at a clip. The distributor that I buy from handles about 1 million pounds a year.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Okay. Ford Motor Company probably gets 1 million pounds delivered, I don't know, a month.
Yeah.
A week. So the problem is with American steel is there's just not enough of it to go around. So when when automotive gets busy, like not only can I not get it, my distributor can't get it either.
Right.
So I have pretty big steel stores, and this is like a little tell-all moment. Before the pandemic, there was a lot of discussion about tariffs for steel.
Yeah.
So I started to get nervous, and I ordered heavy.
Oh,
I was like, the price is going to go way up. So
yeah.
Had I not ordered heavy, we would have run out during the pandemic.
That is,
and so I don't know what I would have done.
When I went to school, they talked so much about just in time. It was like the big thing. Toyota's doing it. It's the rule in the world with just in time manufacturing. And it's all about like the supply chain management. And I was like, this sounds great, but also horrible if there's a hiccup.
Right.
If there's any hiccup at all, I go, your entire thing shuts down. And I said this to the teacher, and they were like, yeah, but they're, yeah, that's what our, you know, they were trying to teach us to be like supply chain managers. That's your job, is just to ensure if there's a hiccup, you find another person. And I said, well, why don't they just like have a warehouse full of raw material? I'm like, well, that's expensive. And I said, that's the price you pay. That's the insurance you're paying against hiccups. And he, like, the teacher's mind was like, well, no. And I said, no, that is, like, to me, I'm like, that's it. You buy the, if you know what you can, if you know what you need for something that you're going to produce, like, get, like, the screwdriver bits aren't going to change drastically, right? Like, you're not talking about, like, little computer, like, you know, Moore's Law, like the stuff that you're producing today on a silicone chip, it's going to be like garbage tomorrow. You're talking about something that's from 1936, you're still producing it today. Yeah, you should probably actually have quite a good stock.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
Why not?
Not work for Chapman Manufacturing.
Yeah.
Not at all. I mean, yeah, we just don't have we don't have the buying power for most things, and suppliers, you know, there's issues. I mean, COVID really changed everything. You know, and it was amazing. You know, even down to the mail, where the U.S. mail is, you know, so we ship out, people that buy on our website, you know, we ship their kits out through the mail.
Yeah.
USPS. So USPS during COVID, it's based on a distribution system. So everything that we send goes out to Springfield, Mass, which is about, I don't know, like an hour and a half away. And then it gets sent to other distribution centers. Mm-hmm. Well, what was happening during COVID was the distribution centers were having like rolling COVID outbreaks. So say Massachusetts would get shut down. They had like a huge COVID outbreak. Okay. So then all of our packages would go to like St. Louis. So then people in New York are like, one, where's my kit? Second of all, why is it in St. Louis?
Yeah.
When you're in Connecticut and I'm in Brooklyn.
Oh, I recall those times. I remember like looking at something that I remember ordering something. It went to Hawaii before coming to me. Now, why is something going for this, like the states to the states? I get Hawaii is a state, but I just remember like, why is this going to Hawaii? Like, it just didn't make any sense. It just happened to be, I don't know why, like to get to Canada, it had to go to Hawaii. It just didn't make any sense, but
it did. That's what was happening. I mean, if you looked at the map, like of the tracking, it was unbelievable. Like a whole tour of the U.S.
Wow.
But a lot of that's leveled out, thankfully. But I think, you know, to sum it up, I think you're absolutely right about just in time. That's all they ever taught me about. And I think, you know, kids 20 years from now are going to be reading in textbooks and in college about, you know, the just in time manufacturing and how COVID, you know, royally messed up that theory.
Well, I think it is a great way of like everything. It's all about the risk. There's risk in it.
Right.
It is a very lean way to manufacture something and to maximize profits. And it's also a very risky way in like, even if it's not COVID, it could be war. It could be anything. Like Baltic birch became almost unavailable for a little while because of the war in Ukraine, right? Like things happen that like globally that we're not in control of. And if your business was dependent on something that comes from another country, it becomes problematic, or even if it's from your country, but you know, another country often is more problematic. But
yeah, absolutely. I mean, I remember in the beginning, one of the ladies that works for us, her husband also is in manufacturing, and they had a container of parts from China. This is like right when COVID hit. And I don't remember whether it was from Yunnan province. It was definitely from China. And they were afraid to open it. So it just sat for like 3 weeks. And they needed the parts, but every single person was like, I ain't going in there.
Right.
And we were all so scared. How long it had
services for, you know, whether it was in the air or not.
It was the time where everyone's like washing their groceries.
Yes. Yeah. Spraying them with alcohol. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, good times. We were so silly. But, you know, I think, you know, so Chapman, if, for those who don't know, like started in a two-car garage.
Yep.
And Brian House, who's just a previous guest, and he does his own podcast, and he has his whole thing, Housemade. He is a big believer that U.S. is part of the next industrial revolution. And I wanted to hear your thoughts on it. Obviously, Chapman's outside of a two-car garage now, but there are a lot of these, like, I think there's a chance now that in U.S. manufacturing that people are going to be starting to have manufacturing businesses that start in a two-car garage again, or one, you know, or a shipping container, wherever you're going to start it. And I wanted to hear your thoughts on that as someone who like owns a business that started back then in a two-car garage. And obviously you weren't there then, but, you know, do you have any thoughts on this, like, potential for the next industrial revolution?
Yeah, I definitely see opportunity.
Yeah.
You know, and really COVID brought that to light where, you know, a lot of people couldn't get parts. You know, globalization is great, but as you said, there's risks to it and there's risks to just in time. And I always feel like when I'm, you know, going to the middle of the internet looking for suppliers, looking for parts, looking for whatever USA made, I can't be the only one. You know, it really seems like in some of these areas, there's business opportunities. And, you know, there is a word for it. It's kind of a recent buzzword that some of the big tool conglomerates are using now called reshoring.
Okay.
Where, you know, they sent everything overseas. And I think Apple, you know, it did this, and now they're bringing manufacturing back to the U.S. And I really had mixed feelings about it because on one hand, I'm like, well, you know, if there's more manufacturing here, I mean, that'll make my life easier when it comes to sourcing. Yeah. But then the petty side of me is like, oh, okay, so you're going to send everything else and then you're going to get celebrated now that you're bringing it back. Well, like, you know, we've been here struggling. Yeah. You know, we've been in the same building since 1965. Like, where's my credit?
Yeah.
You know,
that's fair.
And one of the things is a sidebar that drives me absolutely nuts. Where it seems like, you know, they talk about greenwashing where there's, you know, companies state that things are environmentally friendly and they're not. It seems like there's starting to be a trend where it's almost made in USA washing. Where, yes. I bought something the day and it says like designed in the US.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Made with one part that was, you know, sourced in the U.S. It's like, give me a break.
Well, this is where, like, and I know there's some listeners out here who are going to, like, be mad at me because they don't like government regulation. But there's a reason why, like, made in the USA has a regulation of it needs to be made in the USA. Like, you know, there's a percentage of the product that needs to be made in the USA, right, in order to claim that and get away with it. And I work for the Canadian government, and I get why regulations matter, and it's because there are, if everyone was truthful, it wouldn't matter. You wouldn't need them, but they aren't. That's why you need them.
Yeah, and some people are pushing it. They're really pushing it, and they're pushing me on a personal level. And, you know, and it's interesting, you know, I mean, you think that made in USA is black and white, but it's not, you know. I mean,
yeah.
I know of some companies that they import all their components, they put it together, and then they say made in USA because it was assembled in the USA. So
right. It's hard.
Yeah, I mean, that is made in the USA, but they're not, you know, it's all sourced internationally, where, you know, I'm sourcing all in the US. But to going back to your question, yeah, I think there really is an opportunity. I think we really need some, you know, some new made in USA suppliers, certainly for things like cases, plastic, any kind of plastic components. It seems like all that is made overseas. And especially the small stuff. And, you know, there's a lot of turnover in manufacturing. I personally know of a lot of companies where the owner or the person that, you know, started the company is kind of retired or is looking to retire. So it seems almost like there's a change of the guard looming.
Right. Well, like when your mother took over Chapman.
Yeah.
It like she took it over from people who were in their like 80s or 90s.
90s. Yeah.
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 So, and I'm sure there's a lot more of those companies out there that just need someone who's willing to work for it. Right.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. That's Brian House's podcast name's Work For It. So like, I was trying not to say it, but I did. But, you know, it's like, that's the thing. It's like, you need like those people worked for it. Like they did it. Like,
right.
Like, I'm sure the people who owned that company before, who took it from 19, whenever they bought it, like the 60s till the, you know, whenever they're in the 90s, they were trying to make something work the best they could.
Yeah.
You know, there's always opportunities and obviously, you know, and I know, like, I got a friend who has a business. This is a very successful business, and he has two daughters. And neither one of them wants to take over the business.
Yeah.
Right. And he like kind of took it from his dad and turned it into an even bigger, more successful business. And now he's looking at like he's not quite retirement age, but he's looking in the 10 plus years like, well, what am I going to do? I can't, like, my kids are not interested in it. And it's not really like, it's not the type of business that you can just like sell as a retirement fund, right? Like,
yeah,
handing it to your kids, you feel like happy that they'll be able to take it over. But if you sold it, you wouldn't get the same return.
Yeah.
It's a hard thing.
Yeah. And in, you know, especially in our little area, you know, in Connecticut in general, manufacturing is kind of a bad rap. Understandably, we had a huge industrial complex that, you know, did a lot of polluting.
Yeah.
You know, up until the regulations really started to come in the 70s. I mean, people were dumping everything. And in fact, that happened in our town, our little town. So, you know, people don't always have the best association with manufacturing. There's a lot of Superfund sites around Connecticut, a lot. But, you know, a lot of that has changed. And I think, you know, maybe the younger people don't, you know, if you've never been involved with it, you just hear the bad rap and don't really consider it as an option.
Right.
But, you know, manufacturing isn't what it was in the 70s anymore, with everyone leaning over a machine with a cigarette hanging out of their mouth.
Yeah. Well, you know, in thinking about manufacturing, I want to think about this is going to be the first episode where we talk about the Clamp Challenge for 2024. And for those who are new listeners who weren't listening back when we did the Clamp Challenge before, basically the point of the challenge is that you make a project that involves a clamp. You know, generally speaking, it can be like the clamp can be the raw material for the project, can be the inspiration for the project, can be part of the project. It can be that you made a clamp, basically, you know, but you just like it's a project that involves a clamp or many clamps, because as you all know, you can never have enough. And you turn that into something, you know, functional, artistic, or just, you know, plain fun. And, you know, post that onto Instagram and you'll be in the drawing to have to win some great prizes. One of the prizes is a Chapman Manufacturing screwdriver set. But the basics of it is that it has to be a new project that is completed between the start, which is March 1st, 2024, and the end of the challenge, which is April 30th. We say this, it has to be a new project so that previous clamp challenge projects can't be entered again. you know, but yeah. So basically, you just need to enter your poster project on Instagram with the hashtag #ClampChallenge2024 and tag ClampCast in the post or reel by April 30th, and you'll have a chance to win. So far, we have the Chapman Manufacturing and Housemade Industrial have donated, and there will be more prizes to come. If you're interested in donating a prize, let us know. And but yeah, we're very excited for this Clamp Challenge 2024. If you want the full details of that and everything, is going to be on our website, clampcast.com. So with that, I would like to move on to thanking our Patreon. And just before I do that, every week we're going to be talking about the projects. So make sure you post in progress photos and videos and stories and tag us. And every week we're going to be talking about the projects that we see. And yeah, so you got 2 months to come up with something fun. I know we've teased about it earlier, so hopefully you've all got your ideas in line. And I want to thank our Patreon supporters, especially the F-Clamp level supporters, Scott from Daddy Yourself DIY, Joe Herdina, David Wood from DW Wood Builds, Brad from I'm Gonna Make, and Chad from Chad's Custom Creations. I want to thank everyone who supports us over on Patreon. You get access to the after show. Every month, Gnome Hammer does a hammer draw, and you get an entry into that. And you get a keychain made by yours truly. So just head on over to patreon.com/clamp and you can sign up there if you're interested. And now Clamp Mendations.
Clamp Mendations.
My recommendation, this is not related to screwdrivers at all. It is to, and I'm probably going to butcher it, buy a mocajete. It's a traditional Mexican mortar and pestle thing. Oh. And it is so satisfying to use. Yes. On like a cellular level. Something about smashing your food, whether you're like grinding spices or making salsa or guacamole, is amazing. Mm-hmm. And bonus, if you don't feel like making salsa or guacamole from scratch, you can just buy some from the store and dump it in there, and it looks really impressive.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Wow.
I think I second that recommendation just because the sound of it is so good. I love that. Yeah. It's soothing. It's relaxing. I love it.
Yeah.
Jesse, how are you?
So instead of an Instructables author this week, I just want everyone to go look at the Anything Goes contest winners. I think it closed last week. And this year was perhaps the best entries we've ever gotten. I think I probably spent about 15 hours reading through everything and helping pick finalists and all of that. But it's also exciting just to see all of the new people that we have that have won now. A lot of our listeners are probably familiar with Alley Cats. They won the grand prize. Oh, and it's 3D printed molds for like ceramic art. So it's super unique, really cool use of technology. And really, all of the entries are amazing in some way, and especially the winners. So, you know, if you're feeling kind of in a creative rut, go over there and look and see what people are making, because I was just blown away by all the entries we had this year, and I wanted to give everybody more money.
Well, that is, I always like, so anytime I've thought about entering the Anything Goes contest, I feel like I can't, because it's so like anything goes. And like, yeah. I feel like I don't even know where to go with that. Right. Like I need like direction, but I also see like the amount of like the things that people put into that and the creativity is, I think, just beyond me. And so, yeah, definitely worth checking out.
Absolutely.
I'm going to suggest everyone check out Mara at Silver Hair and Sawdust. She recently put out a maple leaf veneer marquetry thing, and I just think it's really cool because it's maple leaf. And she's a previous Clamp Challenge participant. And I really like it because, you know, Canada and maple leaves and – all that fun stuff. But you should check her out anyways, even if you don't like Maple Leafs. But she's got some great woodworking. And yeah. But
yeah, that maple veneer is amazing. I saw that, I think, yesterday or the day before. I was zooming in on all the pictures. Like, wow, that is so intricate. It's beautiful. It looks like quilting with wood. I love it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just posted the link in the chat if Joel wants to click it so that he could comment on it too. I should have done that earlier. No, we have a Google Doc for those who don't know behind the scenes. We have a Google Doc that we put stuff in. Yeah, there you go. That's There's incredible. A wow. Yeah. Uh-huh.
I love it so much.
Well, yeah. Obviously, the guest doesn't have access to our Google Docs, so I forgot to post up a link. But
cute dog too.
Yeah.
It looks like the dog is the one that made it.
The supervisor, you know.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank TF Turning for our theme song. I want to thank Joel for joining us.
Yes, thank you.
For everyone who wants to find your, Chapman or even yourself, where can they go find you?
ChapmanMFG.com is our website. And I do have a code for your audience.
It's
Clamp24. And that will save you 15% off any master or the master set in any color of your choice. We do have a few colors.
Nice.
Yes.
So you can use that code on our website, chapmanmfg.com.
Right. And we will have that in our show notes, and we'll be posting about it on Instagram. So if you are driving right now and can't write that down, take a look later for that. Clamp24. Looking forward to seeing everyone with their Chapman manufacturing sets. if you want to find Clampcast, you can find us on the Instagrams, Facebooks, YouTubes, and all that by just searching Clampcast. You find Jesse at Jesse Ratfink. You find myself with The Grand Alexander. And until next time, cheers. Have a great day.